Committee, and I'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 618A. Janet, can you get us up to speed?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 618, and you should have the A engrossed bill, was introduced by the Committee on Health Policy at the request of the Nursing Mothers Council of Oregon. It did pass the Senate in an A engrossed version. Mr. Chair, it would require employers to provide unpaid rest periods for employees to breastfeed or to express milk if providing the rest periods does not cause undue hardship on the operation of the employer's business. It requires the employer to make reasonable efforts to provide a private area where employees can breastfeed or express milk. Mr. Chair, it applies to employers who employ 25 or more employees. There's a number of other specifics, but you can look at the findings are in Section 1. There's some definitions, and the requirements are in Section 2. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Janet.
Minimal fiscal impact of the bill, so you don't have a fiscal impact statement. Thank you.
Thank you. Could I have Dr. Lace? And I'm going to have them come up somewhat in panels. Martha Johnson and Cynthia Moab. Good morning, sir.
Good morning, Chairman Brown, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Dr. James Lace. I'm a pediatrician, and I represent the Oregon Medical Association and the Oregon Pediatric Society. I've been a pediatrician here in Salem for approximately 28 years, and as such have been very involved with children and children's health issues. We think that Senate Bill 618 is a very important bill for children as well as for women. Just for a little bit of background information, breastfeeding, from a health standpoint, is very important to us. Children who are breastfed for at least 6 months have a markedly decreased incidence of serious life-threatening infections. They have 5 extra IQ points if you get breastfed for that first 6 months, which I don't know about you, but I could use 5 IQ points periodically in my life. There are other health benefits that go along with that. Breast milk is the only substance that is designed to breastfeed people or human babies. Each animal species has its own milk, and this is uniquely designed for babies, and the longer we can breastfeed babies, the better off we are as a species. The advantages to the mother, health advantages to the mother are huge, decreased incidence of various kinds of cancer, a better recovery in the postpartum period, being able to go back to work, and overall health benefits for the mother. We have other experts in that area that can testify on that. The other thing I'd like to mention to the committee is the whole problem that we have with childhood obesity. As you know, there are a multitude of bills this session dealing with that, some of them going somewhere and some of them not going anywhere. All the studies that have been done to date have not shown that breastfeeding a baby for 6 months increases the risk of childhood obesity. If anything, it's just the opposite. The strength of the studies depends on the largeness of the group, but there's a reduction up to 15% to 25% in childhood obesity. Now, what does that mean? Well, if you look at the statistics that we're dealing with now in our population, and you know from the Oregon Health Plan numbers, if you've been listening, that in Oregon we have about roughly 20% of our children up to age 18 who are obese, and the adult population is 31%. Overweight, you double those numbers. For children, the big issue now is going to be the onset of type 2 diabetes, which is going to translate as an adult eating up a lot of health dollars. Approximately 20% of the Oregon Health Plan dollars go for treatment of obesity-related conditions, and approximately 14% of those health dollars are just for type 2 diabetes alone. So if we can start off right out of the chute, so to speak, with the opportunity to reduce childhood obesity, then we think that this is a very significant bill. And this ends up not costing the state any money to do this. This doesn't involve the Board of Education. This doesn't involve PE. It doesn't involve vending machines in the schools or anything like this. This is strictly a bill that the longer we can get mothers to breastfeed, we look for reducing the incidence of childhood obesity. On a more of a sort of a private note, I am the managing partner for a pediatric clinic here in town. We have approximately 45 employees. And we are like any other, you know, small business employer that, you know, when confronted with the whole issue of, gosh, how do we do this, we had to take a room and put a lock on it, make arrangements for, you know, have electricity and or for the women that are breastfeeding and pumping to have a place for them to put their equipment, a light, and a suitable chair. That's all they really required. We did that, obviously. We're a medical facility, and you think, well, gosh, you should. You're a pediatric clinic. That goes without saying. But we still had to go through the steps of providing that. We still have to go through working out a policy within our office so that a mom who wants to breastfeed can do that. And she doesn't feel, and the other employees in the office don't feel like she's getting an undue advantage because she's got that extra time to pump or whatever. We just say, hey, you've got X number of minutes per four-hour work block time that you're required to take break, and those other times that you're going to need to pump, you're going to just take that off, and it'll be, you know, without pay. And they've all been more than happy to do that. They come back to work faster that way, and they're very satisfied, you know, with that. So, you know, from our standpoint as an employer, we did not find this to be an onerous thing to do.
Thank
anyway,
you,
we would encourage the committee to vote yes on this bill with in a big way. So,
thank you, sir. Any questions of the doctor, Representative Kitts?
I've got just one question. It states here that establishes that provisions apply only to employers who employ 25 or more employees for each working day during each of 20 or more calendar work weeks in the year when rest periods are taken. You read it. What happens if, what comes to my mind is I have a business in my district called Pacific Landscape. They employ probably, if I had to guess, 50 to 100 people. Very big operation. However, most of those people don't work in that building, and it's a building that basically it's two rooms, if you will. You've got the employee break room, and you've got the front entrance where the two receptionists sit. Both these receptionists happen to be female. If one of them were to fall under this, how would this employer who would fall under this, how would they, you know, facilitate something?
Well, that's a good question. As you know, what happens now, oftentimes the women have to go into a toilet, you know, and pump milk in there, which...
I didn't know that.
Yeah, yeah, a lot of men, that's what they end up doing, or they go into some room that maybe they store chemicals or sort of unsafe things, so it's a very unhygienic place, and you think, wait, I'm going to be in there pumping, and I'm going to be feeding my baby this, and so in that situation, if you just have one large room, for example, it could be as simple as putting up a screen. You know, you buy a simple portable, you know, foldable screen, you put it up, some way to make sure that people know that, hey, she's in there pumping, don't go in, please, you know, and some privacy issues, and it could be as simple as that. And electricity doesn't always have to be supplied because a lot of the pumps are run by battery. So it could be as simple as that, and I think the breastfeeding women can speak more to that issue than I can. But it doesn't have to be a complicated, expensive, or even onerous sort of thing to do.
Thank you, Doctor. Any other questions? I don't see any, Doctor. And I have Representative Rosenbaum here. Could I?
Yeah, I'll leave.
You step down, and I'll get her up here, and then we can bring you back up then. Good morning, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for accommodating my or our schedule. I'm here today in support of Senate Bill 618. I'm Diane Rosenbaum, State Representative from House District 42, and want to thank you very much for holding a hearing today on this bill. Women with children and infants are the fastest growing segment of the workforce, both here in Oregon and nationally. And we know that half of all new mothers return to work within 3 months of giving birth, which obviously is a very short time. And as you probably heard from the earlier witness, the American Academy on Pediatrics recommends that women should breastfeed for at least the first 12 months and longer is preferable. If women were given a place to breastfeed or express milk at the workplace, mothers would be able to return to work quickly and do so without jeopardizing the health of their infants. And so we think Senate Bill 618 is a bill that is good for the women and children of Oregon, but also provides accommodation so that it can be made to work in workplaces without undue hardship on employers. The bill urges businesses to allow employees the use of their rest periods for the purpose of breastfeeding, as well as identifying a location for the breastfeeding to take place. We don't see this bill as an inflexible mandate because it simply asks employers to make a reasonable effort to provide a location. But it also says that if doing so presents an undue hardship for that particular business circumstance, that exempts them from the requirement. So it does not require employers that would not be able to accommodate this to do so. We think that the bill will benefit Oregon businesses both by reducing health care costs and also absenteeism, because in fact we know that many new mothers are not able to be at work in some cases at all, or in many cases on an occasional basis because of the needs of parenting. And this results in employees using less sick days and missing less work. And ultimately, it also will reduce insurance costs for the business, because we know that breastfeeding causes children to be healthier, and therefore their health care costs, which the employers ultimately bear, will be lower. Breastfeeding is recognized as the normal and preferred method of feeding infants, and the ability for women to be able to do so at the workplace is long overdue. So I would urge you to pass Senate Bill 618 to the floor, and in doing so, we will join 10 other states that have passed similar laws. That includes California, Connecticut, Georgia, Hawaii, Illinois, Minnesota, Rhode Island, Tennessee, Texas, and the state of Washington. This is a bill that the women and families of Oregon need very much. I've been waiting a long time for, and I hope that you will listen carefully to the testimony of the mothers and the experts and then decide to pass the bill out today. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Representative. Any questions? Representative Holden.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative. I'm very supportive of this, but I'm looking at this trying to, you know, go to my workplace that is outside all the time, and I'm curious how employers are going to deal with situations where their job sites or workplaces are, you know, on location outdoors, and how are employers going to be expected to provide a reasonable place for the
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Holvey, for that question. I mean, one of the points of the bill is that it does not require employers to accommodate if there's an undue hardship on the employer. But there is a provision in the bill for people to rotate to temporarily to a different job duty or job site if that's what's required and agreed upon between the employer and the employee. So I would assume if somebody is working in the field on a regular basis, you know, where they're in a manhole or someplace where it's just not possible to provide a separate location, that maybe what would be worked out in that situation is for that person to go on a different job assignment temporarily where they're working inside in an office environment or a place where it could be accommodated. Obviously, we're not asking for the undoable. So,
any other questions? Representative Kitts.
I've just got one question, and I got to tell you, I'm not uncomfortable with the subject, but it's just a little odd that it's an all-male committee that we're talking to on this subject.
Representative, I did have nothing to do with picking the bill.
So I can state for the record I have no conflict of interest on this bill. Yeah, I don't. I'm just debating whether or not to ask my question.
Maybe it'd be wise if you didn't.
Yeah. I'll pass. I don't even have kids, you know.
If you want to pass a note down this way, maybe one of the other...
Maybe Janet could answer it for me. I think I will do that.
Is there any other questions? Thank you, Representative, for testifying this morning. Ladies, we'll start with one of you. Whichever one wants to start first.
Chair Brown, members of the committee, my name is Cynthia Goodmojob. I live in Hillsboro, for the record, and so Representative Kitts, I'm here as your constituent asking you to support this bill.
I've got my newspaper publisher here also for the next bill, hence the apprehension on my question.
We understand.
Headlines.
Maybe we'll answer it for you along the way.
I hope so.
I wear many hats in the field of breastfeeding, from educator to researcher to international board certified lactation consultant. I'm pleased to be here today to share information with you about why your support of this bill is so important. As you've already heard from two people, infant feeding is a major health issue that cannot be overstated, but is routinely underestimated. So far you've heard about it talked in terms of benefits, and that is the most common rhetoric that is used in the United States today when we talk about infant feeding. Breastfeeding has benefits. When you think about that, that means that we're holding formula feeding as the norm, and we're measuring health outcomes of breastfeeding from the norm of formula feeding and finding them to be superior. If you stop and think which one came first, which one is the biological norm for the human species, we can see that breastfeeding is the biological norm, which means that any benefit you've ever heard about breastfeeding reflects a risk of formula feeding. What we're talking about is trying to help women avoid exposing their infants to the risks of formula feeding, and that's a different emotional experience when you start thinking about it in those terms. So we're looking to protect women and their children in the workplace. And you might think, well, why not just have this be, you know, up to the goodwill of the employer? Yes. There are some employers that will work this out, you know, with the moms and a little bit of creativity, and you can find a way. Unfortunately, we in the field have learned through the work that we do with women that voluntary supportive breastfeeding is unfortunately not a guarantee. As a matter of fact, it's hard to find. That's why we're here. If voluntary worked, we wouldn't be before you today. If there were no consequences to lack of support in the workplace for breastfeeding, we wouldn't be here today. So what we know is that formula-fed infants have a higher risk of illness, disease, and hospitalization. All of that negatively impacts the employer, who then has a mother as an employee who is not in the workplace because she's caring for a child who's sick. It also, formula feeding also increases the risk of learning and cognitive deficiencies through age 18, we've measured. And it also increases the risk of allergy and death. And I've given you 11 pages of well-referenced written testimony. If you'd like to see, you know, what are these figures and where are we coming up with this stuff, you have it. Mothers who formula feed also have higher rates of disease, including breast cancer and osteoporosis. So it matters. That's the reason we're here, is that it matters, and the reason we're here is because women are not getting the support in the workplace that they need. Yeah. We know they're not because we're talking to women, but we also know that the majority of women know about the benefits of breastfeeding. There was research done as part of the U.S. National Breastfeeding Awareness Campaign that showed that the vast majority of women, grandmothers, grandparents, males, everybody knows that there are benefits of breastfeeding, but they're not able to take that knowledge and make breastfeeding happen. There are real social barriers that drop the rate of breastfeeding from where you would expect it to be if there were no barriers in the society. People know, I'm considering breastfeeding, I want to breastfeed, and then you look at the actual rates and they're down. And the reason they're down is because we've got major social barriers, including barriers in the workplace. So we've got, you might think this is, women just need to advocate better in the workplace, and, you know, it's a matter of having some conversations with your employer. Well, I know professional women. I've got a staff engineer that I know who her previous some previous employees there were not able to do anything other than get breaks approved to go into the bathroom and pump. She's very proud that she was able to get a room allocated for breastfeeding, and yet she still is having a hard time getting breaks during her workday. I also know a vice president in finance, very powerful women in the workplace, and she could not get guaranteed break times. She was required to have business meetings at lunch, so she couldn't pump at lunch. What she would end up doing would be drive down the highway on her way to a meeting and pump in the car while driving because she had no time and no place. And if she didn't do this, then if you don't empty your breast, it gets the message, you don't need milk, and your milk supply goes down. So women have to have time and space to breastfeed. And even powerful women in the workplace are not getting that accommodation. So stop and think. Are all women in the workplace powerful? Absolutely not. Do all of them have a private office in which to pump their milk? Do they all set their own schedule? Absolutely not. I would say it's safe to say that the vast majority of employed women in Oregon are not at that upper hierarchy where they could make policy in their workplace and get what they need. So they need you to back them up. They need a bill turned into law that says that they have the right to have this kind of support in the workplace. And again, you've heard from the previous speakers, we're not asking for something that poses undue hardship. We understand that there may be certain circumstances where it's not going to work, we're racking our brains, we're trying to be creative, and something unique to that workplace won't make it happen. Right? We're not asking for the impossible. But for those places of employment that it is possible, let's make it happen so that these women are not at the mercy of the goodwill or the knowledge or the lack of knowledge of their employer about why this is so important. We also understand that this is a sensitive issue, right? Breastfeeding, it's unless you work in our field and you deal with it every day, you know, it can be awkward for people to talk about. And I would encourage any of you, if you've got questions, to ask. We understand that advertising in the United States treats breasts as sex symbols, and we sell beer and cars, and so it can be hard to just come out and talk about this. But if we don't talk about it and, you know, kind of get brave and, you know, just ask the question that we need to ask, then we might not get an answer that can help us with this discussion. So I would encourage you to even ask those difficult questions if you've got something on your mind. So I encourage you to support this bill, and it's the women without power in the workplace that I'm in particular speaking for, because I know that even the powerful women are struggling. I thank you for the opportunity to testify before you today, and if you have any questions, Chair Brown or any of the other representatives, I'd be happy to answer them.
Thank you, Cynthia. Any questions? Representative Escobar.
On the bill itself, it says it permits employer not to provide rest periods for employees to nurse if to do so would impose an undue hardship for employer. Who determines this? I mean, that's my question. Who's determining this?
Do we have experts coming up that are going to be talking about the legal aspects of? All right, Diane Garrett will better address that question than I can. That's more of a legal aspect. I think there is a lot to be said for goodwill in the workplace. If employers understand that this matters, then I think they're more likely to look for solutions and work with women. And I think if women know that they have legislation backing them up, then they also will be more encouraged to participate in that conversation. But that's not the answer you're looking for. You're looking for a specific legal answer, which someone else will give it a go at.
Any other questions? Martha, why don't we go ahead and take your testimony.
Chairman Brown and members of the committee, thanks for this chance to speak to you today. For the record, my name is Martha Johnson. I live at 110 East Hilliard Lane in Eugene. I'm a registered nurse and a board-certified lactation consultant. I'm currently employed at Sacred Heart Medical Center, and I'm also a mom and one of the co-authors of Senate Bill 618. This is the third time that I've participated in bringing a workplace accommodation bill to this legislature. I'm hoping third time's the charm. I want to say right up front that all my testimony is research-based. Like Cynthia, I provided several pages of references that all my statistics are referenced to the medical or scientific literature, so that's where it comes from. In Oregon today, 46% of our workforce is women of childbearing age. The increased participation in the job market has compromised other areas of family life. In my bibliography, I've cited over a dozen studies that show moms who go back to work after having a baby don't breastfeed as long as the moms who stay home with their kids. Other studies I've cited show that moms who receive support at work for breastfeeding do breastfeed quite a bit longer. So when the employer steps up and helps the mom out, it does make a big difference in breastfeeding duration. The next thing that's really important to ask is, why does that matter? Does it make a big difference in health outcomes if a mom only breastfeeds for the time before she returns back to work for, 6 weeks, 2 months, 3 months? And the answer is yes. We have many, many studies that show longer duration of breastfeeding makes a very measurable difference in health, both for moms and for their kids. There's one study that I want to talk about that was published last year by Dr. Marilyn Kwan. She found kids who were breastfed 6 months or less had a 12% reduced risk of leukemia over children who were never breastfed at all, over the formula feeding kids. Kids who were breastfed for longer than 6 months had a 24% reduced risk. So you're cutting your risk in half. Wouldn't you want your own kid or your grandchild to have the lowest possible risk for something serious like leukemia? It's this kind of evidence that forms the basis for the Academy of Pediatrics statement that every child in the U.S. should be breastfed for at least 12 months. There's lots and lots of other research that shows difference in health outcomes, and Cynthia Goodmojob covered a lot of that. The point is that when we have less than optimal health outcomes as a result of this, we pay the bill for that. Every one of us pays the bill for that. And there's very good studies that show in the United States, it's $4 to $5 billion of excess health costs every year because babies are not being breastfed. So now let's take the health research and look at it in the context of the workplace. A mom who goes back to work 2 or 3 months after she gives birth is going to need to keep on breastfeeding for quite a few more months to minimize those health risks that we talked about. Moms need support in order to be successful with breastfeeding after they go back to work, and it can be very simple. The basics are a clean place to pump and some flexible break time during their workday. Now, the way things stand currently, support for breastfeeding in the workplace is left up to luck. The moms who get the support are either lucky enough to have an understanding supervisor or they're plucky enough to make sure that their needs get met. I've been working with new moms and their babies for 18 years, and I can tell you not every mom is lucky or plucky enough to make breastfeeding work in her own workplace. And I have to ask the committee today, in light of the public health and the economic consequences of early weaning, does it really make sense to keep on leaving something this important up to luck? Let's not forget to ask why businesses should do this. Why should they accommodate their breastfeeding workers? What's in it for them? Companies that have breastfeeding support programs report a cost savings of $3 for every dollar they invest in breastfeeding support. So this isn't going to hurt Oregon businesses to do this. It's actually going to help them based on statistics from companies that have done it. Companies that support their breastfeeding workers have less absenteeism because the moms aren't out taking care of sick kids as much. They have reduced health care costs. It's an average cost savings of $400 to $1,000 per baby in the first year of the baby's life. They have better employee morale, improved employee productivity, and a family-friendly image in the community. I want you all to know that we have sat down at the table with AOI several times before and during this session. We've made major concessions to AOI's demands, including raising the threshold from businesses with 8 or more employees to 25 or more and dropping all provisions for enforcement. This bill was written a lot stronger when it was first introduced. The threshold of 25 or more employees only represents 8% of Oregon businesses. AOI has not given an inch. They have pushed and pushed and pushed us, and we have been over backwards to compromise with them. Now AOI wants to remove all the mandatory language making employer support for breastfeeding voluntary. I want the committee to be aware Oregon already has a voluntary program. That's the DHS Breastfeeding Mother-Friendly Workplace Program. That program's been in place for a number of years, and right now less than 40 businesses statewide are participating in it. If Senate Bill 618 becomes voluntary, as AOI now demands, is it going to have the power to make a difference for breastfeeding duration rates in our state? And I ask each one of you to carefully consider my last question. Is it moral? Is it good public policy, and is it economically practical to allow a business lobby to have such a heavy influence on the health of our mothers and children in Oregon? Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Representative Kitts.
I want to make sure I heard you correctly. You said less than 40% are complying with the...
Less than 40 businesses.
Less than 40 businesses.
We have less than 40 businesses participating in the DHS program.
Okay. My question is, not all businesses employ women.
Correct.
Not all businesses employ mothers of newborns. They may employ women, but they may not have had a baby.
Okay.
You follow what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
How many cases have I didn't read your testimony because I was listening to your testimony. How many cases have there been, let's just say the last year, and if that's not a long enough span, that's fine, we'll go 2 years, you just tell me what you're relating the answer to. Have there been a case where there's been a complaint from a nursing mother that my business is completely not accommodating? I've asked. They won't do a thing about it. You get the...
Certainly. Yes, I work for Sacred Heart Hospital in Eugene. It employs 4,000 people, and I've talked to... And what I do is provide breastfeeding support. So some of the moms that work in my company have had beautiful support in their department. Their supervisor makes sure they get out to a break and that they have access to a place to pump. Some of the departments even provide a pump for the moms. I've talked to moms in other departments working for the same company that have had the opposite experience, where I can't get a break, there's no place for me to go except the bathroom, I feel really uptight pumping in the bathroom and my milk dried up. You know, eight weeks into coming back to work, my son weaned because I didn't have enough milk for him. So,
I appreciate that, the sentiments and the feedback that mm-hmm. you're getting from your people at your work. But my question is are there any, you stated empirically, according to you, that your testimony is based on research and data and,
okay.
and X, Y, and Z. I'm curious if there are any data out there available that says that this is a problem, that people are filing complaints, that people have said, I tried to do this, I asked my mm-hmm. employer, you know, I'm obviously nursing. It's time. I need to mm-hmm. do this. And the employer said, "No, get back to work. Let mm-hmm. it dry up."
Yeah.
If that's the case, I cited. Is there evidence
currently,
of a problem out there?
Currently, there's no clearinghouse to which people can file complaints. That, like what you're describing, but there's a number of references in my testimony that show when moms go back to work, they don't breastfeed as long, and the reasons why, the studies show very clearly what the barriers are, and, you know, it has to do with they're not getting break time, and they're, you know, their employers aren't supportive.
Okay, and may I have one follow-up? We go back to the previous gentleman, I apologize, I don't remember his name, but he was sitting right
here. Dr. Lace?
Yes, thank you. He cited in my example of I had this landscape company that has a front reception mm-hmm. area and a back break area, and he stated that a screen mm-hmm. could be used to provide that privacy. Who would be responsible for buying that screen? I mean, is that something that the mother, as she buys a stroller and a crib and would buy a screen to take to work, or would the employer be required to keep that on hand in case the situation ever presented itself?
I don't think it's an in-case thing. I think that the bill does say the employer is required to provide a room or other location. So the screen would be the other location. And yes, I believe
that.
It's the employer's responsibility, yes.
Okay. You believe it based on the bill?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Schaffer.
Thank you. I've only been a parent once, and when our daughter was born, my wife took our daughter to her office that she owns and set up a nursery. And the longer I'm a parent, the more I realize how lucky I am. I got no money, but I'm mighty rich. I think the logistics are what people are concerned about, the logistics of all this.
That's right.
And I will leave that to you to explain how it's going to be worked out, but... Have you read the amendment? You're familiar with the amendments. My question to you all is the bill with the amendment an improvement on what we have, and would, or was is it the bill as it's written now or nothing, or would the bill with the amendment improve on what we have right now in the state? That's my question.
Which amendment are you referring to?
The AOI amendment.
Don't have one.
Oh, forgive me, I thought we did. I apologize, Mr. Chair.
Because I don't have one. Maybe I missed it.
I am sorry.
This committee, or this bill was amended in the Senate and removed some of the language that shows up there on top.
Forgive me, Mr. Yeah. Chair. I must have had the wrong conversation on it.
Did you want to state for the record you have no conflict with this bill?
Any other questions? I don't see any. Thank you, ladies, for your testimony. I appreciate it. Could I have Steve Lanning and Diane Garrett and Sue Woodbury? Oh, did she? Okay. I'm going to get all the fours. Which is with your... Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Steve Lanning. I'm with the Oregon AFL-CIO. We represent 180,000 union members in the state of Oregon. We supported this bill on the Senate side, and we've supported it in past sessions. And we are supporting it, obviously, this session in the House side as well. We believe that the protections that are included in the bill, although they may need to get worked out a little bit, some of the details, we think that there's enough protections for employers as far as the hardship goes. And the amendments that happened on the Senate side that took out the enforcement provisions, we felt would be helpful to business as well. So we're in support of it, and we'd like to see this bill move. It's an issue that's not covered in very many, or hardly any, union contracts, although we represent a lot of women, and it's issues that union reps can deal with in the workplace because they have the ability to do that, and this would be good for those folks that don't have union protection as well. Thank you.
Thank you, Steve. Whichever one of you ladies would like to be next, please.
I'll be happy to. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Sue Woodbury. I'm the Program Manager for Nutrition and Health Screening for Department of Human Services. I have provided written testimony for you. I am here today to ask you to support Senate Bill 618A, which would contribute to improving the health of Oregon's women and children. Improving breastfeeding rates is a goal which addresses many of DHS programs. This bill supports our obesity prevention efforts. Breastfeeding is a component of the DHS Physical Activity and Nutrition Grant, or PAN grant, that you've probably heard about. It supports our chronic disease and cancer prevention efforts. Longer breastfeeding is associated with lower rates of breast cancer and osteoporosis for mothers, and lower rates of diabetes and leukemia for children. The bill supports our efforts for the WIC nutrition program to help low-income working moms continue breastfeeding by providing breast pumps. The bill also supports our breastfeeding mother-friendly employer project that you heard addressed earlier. That project is designed to educate employers on the importance of supporting breastfeeding mothers. The single greatest barrier to breastfeeding is returning to work. Returning to work can be a barrier for many mothers, but it's particularly problematic for low-income mothers receiving state assistance. Rules from the Temporary Assistance for Needy Families program, or TANF, and the JOBS program require that mothers return to full-time training or employment by the time their infant is 3 months old. Without employer support, children in low-income families have little chance of having access to the health prevention and protection that breastfeeding provides. The fate of children, of our children's health, and our efforts to address the epidemic of obesity, the skyrocketing health care costs, would all be served by the passage of this bill. Passage of this bill would be an important step in improving the health of Oregonians and would particularly benefit the children of low-income households. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Diane, would you like to go ahead then, please?
Good morning, gentlemen. For the record, my name is Diane Garrett. I'm a breastfeeding mother. I'm a native Oregonian, and I'm a volunteer peer counselor with Nursing Mothers Council of Oregon. We're honored to be here today. Thank you for hearing our bill. The community that is Oregon has not yet moved to protect breastfeeding as it relates to the workplace. And until we do so, it will be vulnerable to the pressures and business interests that are our market economy. I would like to suggest to you today that thinking about breastfeeding in the workplace only in terms of economic viability is unprofitable. Appropriate thinking about breastfeeding starts with a baby, and our decisions ought to be guided by that first and foremost. I assure you, babies don't come into the world screaming, laissez-faire! Their first cry is for another human being and for the mother's milk. If there's one thing I've learned in my own breastfeeding experience, it's that when I am responsive and intentional, my baby will thrive. It's not any different on a community level. That means we must decide on a strategy for Oregon's workplace, which includes 466,000 women of childbearing age. To acknowledge the benefits of breastfeeding for our children and then hold back because we want businesses to have a choice on who feels like helping and who doesn't sends the wrong message. I submit to you that breastfeeding should not be for sale in this state. Certainly, there are businesses who have been responsive to employees and have chosen to cultivate a workplace that encourages and endorses breastfeeding. Associated Oregon Industries is such a place. When I encourage them to be recognized as the DHS Breastfeeding Mother-Friendly Employer Program, what a mouthful that Sue just described, because they are a leader in the business community on this, they refused. Why? Because that program is designed to help employers voluntarily write their own policy, and AOI will not write their own policy because it decreases flexibility and increases liability. If this is an indication of the majority of its membership, I feel even more compelled to ask for the state to set a fair standard. I'm going to get really brave here, and I'm going to ask for a work session today. We could talk more. There's more data. I'm sure you're totally blown by how much data there is to go through, and the pile is growing. If you wish, I have an amendment that I can give to you that will create a legislative task force so that you guys can underscore what mothers and babies have known since they've been human beings. In the meantime, 40,000 and more babies will be born to us each year. And how will we make an answer for them? Why delay? Setting a fair standard for 8% of Oregon's employers is the least we can do. And I want your unanimous vote. Thank you.
Thank you, Diane. Representative Shoffler.
Thank you. And, you know, I'm sorry there's just guys up here that would be voting on this, too. It's kind of uncomfortable, to say the least. I should have asked you this in our discussions in the past, and maybe somebody else has an answer. Have other states done this? I had another question. Well, are there other models?
Let me start with that one.
Yeah, very good. Thank you.
Minnesota was the first state in the country to pass legislation in 1998. Mm-hmm. Their legislation is very similar to ours. There's no penalty for noncompliance, and it applies to all businesses in the state. 1998, their breastfeeding rates in 1997, and then to 2002, their breastfeeding rates have doubled. I don't see any liability in that. California passed legislation in 2001. Theirs does carry a penalty of $100. Haven't seen them go out of business yet. So it is working. It does send a positive cultural message that this is the norm and this is reasonable to expect.
Thank you. Representative Schaffer.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And this, we just got this today, I believe. Yeah, Representative Rosenbaum points out that there's 10 states, actually. The 40 businesses that do have these policies in place, God bless them, are any of them represented here today? Did any of those folks come here? But I would like to hear from them, too. That would have helped a lot, I think. But how it's had an impact, positive, negative, financially.
I could speak. I work in the Portland State Office Building. Health Services is located there, and all of the services that are part of VHS are part of. We are a breastfeeding-friendly employer. The setup in the office building is that a room that prior was a meditation sort of, if you aren't feeling well, sort of sick room, was set aside as a breastfeeding room. It's part of our wellness center. We're public health. We're committed to wellness. It sits inside our wellness center. It's used extensively. But we aren't a private employer. I can't speak.
You follow, Mr. Chair, please.
One more.
Okay, I apologize for taking so much time. I mean a business for profit. That's what I think would bolster and strengthen your argument markedly. And I don't know what we're going to do, but in the future.
I did invite them to come.
Great. Thank you.
I did issue the invitation, make it known that their presence would be welcome here.
And just for the record, you have a compelling argument. I'm glad you're here. And I'm certainly, none of these guys up here are against breastfeeding women. I just want to make sure everybody knows that.
Well, just in reply to that, I appreciate your support. But once again, acknowledging the benefits of breastfeeding is not, it's not enough. We must be intentional as a culture if babies are going to thrive here.
Thank you, folks, for your testimony today. I appreciate you coming. Thank you again. Could we have Julie Brandis? And this will be the last person. We got a real time crunch coming down the stretch looking at us. The speaker set a second house session on us, and so it's going to eat up a great deal of our time.
Okay. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Julie Brandis with Associated Oregon Industries. Before I talk to the bill this session, the bill before us today, this week represents my 15th year at Associated Oregon Industries. I'm very proud of my service there, and I'm very proud of the organization. I will not have the motives of my organization impugned, or the fact that my boss tries to have a flexible work policy in his organization impugned. It is because of that once a breastfeeding mother, I now have a dyslexic child who requires an excessive amount of time, and it is that flex time policy, not having a letter written about how every employee has to be governed, that gives me that flexibility. I will not have him impugned in this committee. To Senate Bill 618. I think I'd like to respond first to some questions, then talk about the letter of the law as the bill is written, and then talk about what we would propose. The first thing to talk about is undue hardship, because that has come up a great deal today. What is undue hardship to the employer? The terms reasonableness and the terms undue hardship pervade the law. They are all throughout the law. And a good example is the American with Disabilities Act. So when we ask our HR managers throughout the major companies in this state, many of them who do provide opportunities already for breastfeeding, you know, how would you comply with this? They do need guidance. You cannot think that a broad term reasonable is the guidance that they need. And then look to the letter of the law. Oops, I forgot to turn in my testimony. Pardon me. And this will be on the front page of your testimony. Section 3. The language is confusing because it starts out by saying reasonable unpaid rest period, but later says the employers must provide 60 minutes per 8-hour shift. So does that mean anything less than 60 minutes is unreasonable? Now, you tell me on the record what the answer is, because I'm going to get a call the day this bill goes into effect from an HR manager saying, what do I need to do? I think it's also important to talk about the program that is provided by the state currently. As I understand that program, the Department of Human Resources Office of Family Health does have a program, but it is important to note that that is not a proactive program. They are not reaching out specifically, doing mailing lists to mailings and such to the business community. You have to kind of know it exists, and you have to sign up. And I don't again think that that's saying that 40 companies belong to that. How much outreach has really been done in an aggressive fashion? How much outreach is done with, there are about 200 major, or there are about 200 business organizations throughout the state, associations. How much work has been done with them to educate their employers? To the letter of the law, there's nothing in here about proportionality, so if you work less than 8 hours. In Section 3, Subsection 5, the bill states that the employer may make reasonable efforts to allow an employee to temporarily change duties if the employee's job duties do not allow breastfeeding or expressing milk. This causes great conflict with Oregon's family leave law. Second question, I'll get on the day that this bill becomes law. How am I supposed to balance that? Because under Oregon law, I'm required to return somebody to the exact same position. In Section 3, Sub 2, the bill requires employers to provide reasonable efforts to breastfeed or express milk. Expressing milk is one thing. It requires a breast pump. That is what we use. That is how our boss accommodates us at AOI. Breastfeeding obviously requires a baby. Is the employer mandated to reasonably accommodate a baby in the workplace if it doesn't create an undue hardship? Nothing in this bill requires an employee to notify the employer that she will need accommodation in time and place when returning from family leave. So I came back from family leave after 3 months at AOI. When I was gone for 3 months at AOI, I came back. You know, I'd already talked to my boss about what timing I needed because he wanted to know. And, of course, I've already explained to you that my boss is very flexible at AOI. Mostly what he wanted to know is what hours I decided to work. AOI remains concerned that the mandates for reasonable accommodation may be difficult for some employers. Under the proposal, an employer shall make reasonable efforts to provide a room or other location than a public restroom, toilet stall. How is this supposed to occur without notification? You asked the question, Representative Kitts, who pays for it? The employer pays for it. Some notification is needed so the employer can put the money together and make the changes, whether it's a room or whether it's a screen or whatever the case might be. Representative Kitts, you asked if there was any statistics. We don't have a broad-based survey of Oregon employers. We did do a statistically significant survey of of AOI members throughout Oregon on what they're doing for breastfeeding. 44% of our members said that, yes, they were doing something for breastfeeding mothers. 14% said no. And 42% said they weren't sure. And I have to tell you, we did interview CEOs and COO level people members in the business community. And my guess is many of those people actually probably don't understand what their policy is because that's in the HR department. Then we asked the question, why doesn't your company provide time for working mothers to express milk? And 73% of them said it doesn't apply. We don't have female employees. Hasn't been an issue. Family-run business, small. And then the next question is the time provided to express milk flex time? Now, I would never, and the majority of them said yes, it was. Now, I would never make an inference on Oregon businesses based on this survey, but I can make an inference based on AOI members. AOI members utilize flex time. The more policies the state forces upon the employer, the less flex time there will be. The last page of my testimony today is the amendments for consideration. I understand the proponents do not support these amendments, so unless I hear otherwise, I won't have them drafted. But in the next week, what we would consider is removing the terms reasonableness and reasonable accommodation. Again, those pervade the laws. That pervades the law. Remove the mandates and remove. But then to add It's the policy of the state of Oregon to encourage employers with 25 employees or more to encourage opportunities. Employees seeking opportunities are encouraged to notify their employers 1 month before a room or space, etc., is needed. The Department of Human Resources Office of Family Health shall develop a proactive program that consists of website information, mailings, and working with trade associations. And then here's a final point for your consideration. The Bureau of Labor and Industries will report to the next legislature possible policies that allow the pooling of break times. Under Oregon law, we are required after about the first 2.5 hours of work to provide a 10-minute break. And then in the afternoon, we provide after 2.5 hours, a 10-minute break. And then generally sometime if there's an 8-hour shift, a 30-minute unpaid lunchtime. But we cannot pool those times. We have no flexibility under the law. So if this is an important policy of the state, then the state agency that manages time and hour and wages should be doing something about it to help the employer. So those are some of the suggestions that we would have to improve this legislation.
Representative Schaffler.
Thank you. If we ever pool that time, I want it to be at the discretion of the employee, not the employer. Ms. Brandis, you interviewed 300 of your members, and 44% of that, if I'm reading this graph correctly, said that they do provide time for this. That number is a lot more than 40 businesses then. So apparently these are all Oregon businesses. So apparently there's like 125 businesses just of your members alone. And did any of them businesses come here today on either side of this issue?
Mr. Chair, members and Representative Schaffler, no.
Okay. And then, this is the last one. Have you examined any of the other 10 states' policies that deal with this?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, yes, I have. Diane Garrett provided me that information, and I did take a look at that. They range,
mm-hmm.
obviously. Some don't have the enforcement. Some have, I would say, a less severe mandate than what you have here.
Thank you. Representative Kitts.
Mr. Chair, I've been informed that it looks like we're going to be able to extend our committee, so I would appreciate the opportunity to ask the question.
Sure.
I got two questions. Number one, if there's no penalty, if there is a penalty, I can't find it. I think they testified and agreed that there's no penalty. The enforcement provisions are taken out. So I'm going to walk you through. I'm an employer. I fall under this criteria. I just don't do it. What happens?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I don't know. But I'll give you an example because I've been asked that question. Oregon law requires... And this is no comparison to the importance of breastfeeding. And I do wholeheartedly agree with the proponents that breastfeeding is very important. The role you have today is to balance the role the state has in balancing a working mother's life versus the benefits of breastfeeding. Representative Kitts, on a completely different example, Oregon employer retailers are required to offer paper and plastic. And under the law, we're required to ask, do you want paper or plastic? There's no enforcement in the law. But our businesses feel as though they have to comply with the law. And so they'll have to implement it. So even though there's no enforcement, they'll still be complying with the law. I don't know what happens to an employer who doesn't comply, except for the terms reasonableness and undue hardship will have to be defined at some point, and it most likely will be through a court.
Follow-up, if I might.
All right, one follow-up.
One follow-up. To respond to that, I would also say that if this is law as stated, it says specifically, it doesn't say that there's a penalty for enforcement. So I wouldn't imagine that there would be any repercussions to the employer that chooses simply not to do it. But that's my thought. I'm not an attorney. I'm not a judge. My second question is, realizing that the cost incurred to the employer, if they're able to do this, i.e. a screen or whatever that may be, is the situation. We're all in agreement here that breastfeeding is good and has its benefits.
Certainly.
I think you stated that as well. Would an acceptable compromise in this situation be to adhere to the guidelines here as long as there is no cost incurred to the employer. So, for example, you follow the guidelines here, but an individual that is breastfeeding at this point in time could buy their own $30 screen, bring it to work, and set it up, and shift the burden of the expense for that to the other person. I don't know if the other side's agreeable to that, but it just seems like the outlined criteria here is not the huge objection. It's the cost and the burden, because if they're not able to do it, they don't have to do it by the way the bill is written. But if they're able to do it, then they would be, you know, subject to these requirements.
Mr. Chair, Representative Kitts, first of all, there are two things. If there was no cost, that is certainly one thing. But you have to, again, go back to the standards that are established in the 618-A. And how it is set forth is very confusing and was likely to cause problems within an HR department of a company with 25 or more. The confusion between reasonableness and 60 minutes. How to handle time proportionately. Do you have to accommodate a baby unless it's an undue hardship? I think the other thing to keep in mind is, let's see if this is actually... You know, I think when you look at the term reasonableness standard, and I think you're getting to this, Representative Kitts, is what are the standards for the employee? So if we place more of the emphasis on what the employee is required to do, and as to, for example, is it reasonable, what is the reasonableness, that's a hard word for me to say, standard for the employee as to not to unreasonably interfere with the performance of her duties or the operations or the expenses of the employer.
Thank you, Julie, for being here this morning. And with that, we've worked our way through the list of people that are signed up, so I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 618 and open the public hearing on Senate Bill 323. Janet,
thank you, Mr. Chair.
Well, I
Senate Bill 323 was introduced by Senator Walker and Representative Brown at the request of the Independent Contractors Task Force. You should have been distributed and probably have seen at the beginning of session the report from the Independent Contractors Task Force that met during the interim. This task force met as a result of Senate Bill 232 last session. Senate Bill 232 rewrote the definition of independent contractor, but also set up a task force to look at the definition, and the task force did recommend additional changes to the definition. So what you have is a repeal of the current definition that was drafted in Senate Bill 232 last session, rewritten, and the rewriting starts in the bold language on page 2. Mr. Chair, the independent contractor definition applies to income tax statutes, workers' compensation statutes, unemployment insurance, architects, landscapes, and construction contractors, as well as other portions of state law. And that's why there's a number of statutes that are amended. Part of the key in the new definition in Senate Bill 323, and it is the original bill, the Senate did not amend the bill, is found starting on page 2, lines 30 and 31. You meet the definition of independent contractor if you meet any of three of the following, and there's five different criteria. So that's kind of where a lot of the meat of the bill is. Mr. Chair, you have at your place also dash 5 and dash 6 amendments. The dash 6 amendments are merely conflict amendments to a bill that's already passed, House Bill 2446. That's the tax statute revision bill, and there was one statute that needed to be revised. The dash 5 amendments, I think one of the witnesses will probably speak to. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Janet. Could I have Lisa Trussell and Elizabeth Harchenko, please? Oh, Senator Walker's there.
El Presidente.
Good morning, Senator.
Good
Good morning, Mr. Chair. Vicki Walker, State Senator, District 7. I feel like I'm part of your committee. I've been here so much lately. I appreciate
we need some good help.
I was kind of joking out in the hallway that you must all have been a little uncomfortable talking about breastfeeding when you're all men. But, you know, it's a good topic, and I'm sure that you all partook of that when you were growing up as little babies. So, enough said about breastfeeding. Mr. Chair, I am here today on Senate Bill 323, and you and I know what this bill is about.
We've lived it for the last 6 years.
We have. And, colleagues, I'm a Democrat, and, you know, we had an interesting, amazing, isn't it, that I am.
God bless you.
But we've had an interesting discussion over in our chamber this morning about nonpartisan legislatures, and so you will be getting that bill later today. It just popped over the chamber. But what was interesting is that a majority party member filed a minority report, and that passed. So it was fascinating. But I bring that up because Democrats, I mean, this has been a partisan issue for a long time, and it never should have been a partisan issue. Every time we get this bill passed to change the way independent contractors are looked at, it passes one chamber if Republicans are in control and doesn't pass the other. Well, last session, Mr. Chair, I passed it in a chamber full of Democrats. We were 15-15, and I think it surprised some of the folks who have long supported leaving things as they were that I was able to get enough support in my chamber to listen for a change, because we've needed change for a long time on this bill. People who are independent contractors need that definition that they're independent contractors, and we also need to make sure that employers are not taking advantage of scamming the system and calling someone an independent contractor when they're really not. So you and I got the distinct pleasure of being appointed to the Independent Contractor Task Force in the interim because that was created as a result of Senate Bill 232 last session.
Yeah, I see that.
And you and I met with that task force, I think almost monthly we met. We met a lot, an awful lot. And for the first couple of meetings, Mr. Chair, we kind of whacked around everyone, you know, we kind of took pot shots at each other and staked out our position, which is kind of the way task forces work. You know, everybody has to get it out of their system. And then we got to work. And I think what we came up with is really pretty darn good. And it clarifies really who is an independent contractor, how you qualify, because times have changed now in our society, and we have different kinds of jobs that we work at. A lot of us work from home. A lot of us consult. We just don't necessarily have an employer. I've been an independent contractor for 22 years, Mr. Chair, and I work for the Federal Bankruptcy Court, but I also work for attorneys and do other things as a court reporter. So I understood the need to have this clarified, and Senate Bill 323, these two wonderful people on either side of me are going to give you the great details about it. But Mr. Chair, we've had some people coming with some amendments. Now, I know there's a Dash 6 conflict amendment. That should be a slam dunk. But there are other amendments floating around that I think we need to be very, very careful about. I would like to just speak to that briefly. The newspaper folks have come in with an amendment saying that they need to make sure they're an exception under the law and that their stringers are exempt. Well, Mr. Chair, if they're truly a stringer, I don't think they need an exemption under the law. If you work for more than one employer and you meet the other parts of the test, you shouldn't have to have an exemption under the law. In fact, I will tell you that I recently spoke to a newspaper reporter who said that when one of his friends graduated from journalism school, he went to work for a newspaper. This newspaper made him sign a contract that he would work for them 30 hours a week and he would work for no one else and that he would be an independent contractor. That's not really the way the rules work. So I know that goes on out there, and I want you to think carefully about that amendment when it comes forward, because if they meet the test, they shouldn't have anything to worry about. And what this bill does is clarifies the test, Mr. Chair, and it provides so much good work that the department, the employment department, can give people advance rulings. They can give them information about if they're setting up a business, do you meet the test? Before they get caught up in the trap and get fined huge amounts of money, you have recently been approached about the musician issue. If they had called, if we had this system in place, maybe that wouldn't have happened and they wouldn't have been slapped with a fine. It's really, really important for us in government to be proactive and help people understand how our government works, because we're not here to be punitive. We're here to be helpful. We're the government, and we're here to help you. Isn't that the saying? That can be very scary, but it also can be the truth, Mr. Chair. So because we took so long on the floor in the Senate today, I've got to run to a meeting. And, Mr. Chair, I know that these two fine women who are just really awesome. Ms. Trussell did a great job as chair of the task force, and Ms. Roshenko has done a wonderful job, and we have some other people who are on the task force who would like to testify. So I'm going to leave it in their hands unless you have any questions.
Thank you, Senator. Any questions? Don't say thank you for coming to testify.
And
thank you for all the work.
Yes, and thank you also, Mr. Chair. It was a pleasure meeting with you, even though it was in that room that we all know and hate.
Room 50.
Yeah, room 50.
Very cool, huh?
Yeah. Lisa?
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Lisa Trussell, and I represent AOI, but today I'm here in the capacity of the chair for the Independent Contractor Task Force. And they're handing out some testimony to you now, and I want to thank and acknowledge the efforts and hard work of both Senator Walker and yourself on this task force that at times felt like it would never end. What I'm going to do is I'm going to provide you some background on the task force, our work, and then Ms. Arshenko will discuss with you the bill, and she'll walk you through the bill and go over the highlights of it. For a little background information, prior to the 2003 session, the definition of independent contractor was in the Oregon Revised Statute 670.600, and that definition was created in 1989. And when it was created, it was to apply to the Revenue Department, the Employment Department, and the Workers' Comp Division. And as you can imagine, businesses have changed significantly since that time. And while the Employment Department and the Revenue Department were still using that definition during the transitional times, Workers' Comp definition was changed by a court case. So they had case law to follow on Workers' Comp. Last session, there was an effort to change the definition for all three agencies. What finally passed, though, was Senate Bill 232, not to be confused with Senate Bill 323, which established a new definition of independent contractor, but just for the Department of Revenue. And that definition, if no action is taken by this legislature, is set to go into effect January 1st of 2006. Also a part of Senate Bill 232 was the establishment of an independent contractors task force to study the issues related to the whole definition of independent contractor. And we had the appointments to the task force made in November of 2003. I drew short straw and was chair of it. The final report that you have, was the report distributed to the committee?
Yeah, we have it.
In the report, you can see a list of all of the different, first page, all the different interests that were involved in the task force that I know the chair is extremely familiar with. We had 10 meetings, and we had these meetings to do a variety of things. We gathered information, discussed issues, we made findings, and we formulated the final recommendations, which are in the report, and they're also those final recommendations were also taken, and that's what you have before you in Senate Bill 323. Let me summarize some of the key findings of the task force. We found that there is some confusion among employers, workers, and professional advisors created by the differing standards between the agencies and the interpretations of the existing laws. So there's unfair competition created by business firms that misclassify workers as independent contractors. So people that are counting them as employees have a higher rate than if they're not counted as employees. There was a finding that there should be enhanced, more consistent, and coordinated enforcement and compliance activities, and that is a key to what our report is based on. There should be greater understanding and ease of compliance for employers and workers. There's a desire that any new definition not result in the erosion of the social safety net for workers, and that's addressing unemployment and workers' compensation systems. And that the statutory definition of an independent contractor should be consistent for the impacted agencies, employment, revenue, and workers' comp. Now, the summary of recommendations are a legislative concept for a definition of an independent contractor that is consistent for the impacted agencies, thereby also allowing for greater coordinated standards, interpretation, application, and enforcement. And that is a key element of our work. It addresses the concerns about the possible erosion of the social safety net and protection for workers. And it addresses the concerns and interests expressed by employer, worker, and agency representatives who are a part of the task force. And we've also come up with a recommended set of enhanced and coordinated agency administrative services, such as a web-based application for information, including a home web with general information for employers, workers, and the public on reporting and compliance topics related to independent contractor. Development of industry-specific guidelines to assist employers, workers, and the public to better understand the interpretation and application. And, for example, I was in attendance at a meeting with Chair Brown where we were presented with an example of this very industry-specific guideline that California has that they send out, and this happened to be to musicians. But the idea is to have to take a look at the workplace that exists today and come up with industry-specific guidelines to help you before you make the decision determine whether someone is an independent contractor or a worker, or it may be the individual themselves trying to determine what status they fall in. And offering, we have voluntary consultation services such as technical assistance and consultation sessions with agency reps, very similar to the Oregon OSHA consultation program that we're all familiar with. The development of a coordinated and consistent compliance strategy that has preventative and corrective tools such as joint rulemaking, joint auditing to avoid multiple audits, and institution of web-based or hotline compliance information and reporting. If we only had one agency coming in to do an audit, that would free a lot of my members' times instead of having three different agencies come tapping three different times.
Mr. Hood, they're all there to help.
Yeah. I'm frequently reminded of that. Thank you. And development of an explanatory notice that may be used to help educate employers, workers, and the public about what the rules are regarding an independent contractor. And then I'll close. I want to make three points. We achieved agreement on a new definition for purposes of employment in the revenue department, and we were really close on workers' comp, but we couldn't reach total agreement on workers' comp during our guideline, and there's been continued efforts to address the workers' comp recommendations, but we've been unable to reach consensus, so we've dropped our efforts to submit the workers' comp language in Senate Bill 323, but even without that, I think there'll be much more aligned. Second, throughout the task force deliberations and this process, the legislative process, we've resisted efforts to create separate and individual carve-outs or exemptions. Senator Walker mentioned the stringers. There were discussions by others as well, and you may hear from more today that want to be carved out of the definition. The task force consensus remains that the bill is recommended in its current form is what the task force reviewed and endorsed. And I want to emphasize that there's going to be a process to look at industry-specific issues. And I would encourage this committee to pass the bill as it's written. Let the process work. We've got we'll be putting it in place very soon because we have to do something prior to January 1st. And then if there are issues that can't be addressed to an industry satisfaction during the process, then come in 2007 with a bill to address those specific concerns. You know, we had the meetings that we held were public meetings. We heard from a lot of different groups, and a lot of the issues that may or may not come forward today were thoroughly hashed out during the task force meeting. And the lastly, I want to point out a major concern, and that if nothing is done, or this bill gets weighted down with political fighting, the law that passed in 2003, Senate Bill 232, will go into effect, and that will happen January 1st. So what will happen is that Employment Department will have a definition, Revenue will have a new definition, Workers' Comp will still have their definition, and then, of course, my members will be impacted by the federal definition. So,
isn't that the way we generally operate?
Mr. Chair, I'm hoping that we can change that. This would not only give us, you know, three obviously different definitions for the agency, but it will also impact the quarterly reporting, because right now employers can submit combined quarterly reports. That would be affected for, and that will have impact on both employers and the agencies. And with that, I will stop talking, and I would ask Elizabeth Harshenko to go over the bill with you.
Thank you, Lisa. Good morning, Elizabeth.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Elizabeth Harshenko. I'm the director of your Department of Revenue. I served as the governor's representative on this task force, and I'm here today to just take you through the provisions of the bill. The new language begins on page 2 of the bill. The first two sections, the amendments, are the same. There are two versions of ORS 670-600 that are out there, one that is currently effective and one that will become effective January 1, 2006, if it's not changed. And so both of those are changed and made consistent in the bill. First, the old language establishing a test for how a person is determined to be an independent contractor is removed, and a new test is inserted. There are definitions of just the basic terms. What do we mean when we use the word individual, person, and services? And then the bill, starting on page 2, line 19, goes into the definition of an independent contractor. That is basically a four-part test to begin with. The first part of the test is that the person is free from direction and control over the manner and means of how they provide the services. This is a classic element of a person who is independent as opposed to being an employee. The second part of the test is that the person is customarily engaged in an independently established business. And that is defined a little bit later in this section. Also, if they are required to be licensed under either ORS Chapter 671 or 701, which are for construction or landscape contractors, they have to have those licenses. And if any other license or certificate is necessary under law for them to engage in their trade or profession, they have to be responsible for obtaining those licenses or certificates. The key part of this definition is subsection 3, starting on line 30, which sets forth five elements that are reflective of people that the task force concluded were engaged in independently established businesses. A person needs to show that three of those five apply to them in order to satisfy the test to be an independent contractor. Those criteria are that the person has an identifiable business location that's separate from that of the person for whom the services are provided. That can be in their own home if they work out of their home, or it can be a separate office that they maintain for themselves. But it has to be, they have to have something that has some separation. They need to bear the risk of loss if their services or work product doesn't meet specified results. They need to provide services to two or more customers in a year, or they need to be advertising, soliciting business, or doing other things to market their business. They must have made a significant investment in their business. They have to have the right to hire and fire assistants to perform the services. And as I said, three out of those five things, if an individual demonstrates those and they are free from direction and control of the person for whom they're providing services, they qualify as an independent contractor. There are some special provisions that appear on page 3, starting on line 11. When it comes to people who are providing farm labor or farm services, there's an exception from the risk of loss requirement. Line 14 on page 3 of the bill indicates that creation of a business entity, whether it's a partnership or a corporation or a limited liability company, doesn't by itself either establish that somebody is or isn't an independent contractor. And that's the fundamental core definition. The rest of the bill, starting on Section 3, is about administration and how this law fits into the rest of the statutory scheme. Section 3, in addition to the current statutory requirement that the agencies adopt rules together, has an affirmative statement that requires the agencies to cooperate in administration and enforcement in order to achieve consistent implementation and application of these statutes. And Lisa described the elements of the report of the Independent Contractor Task Force. Participating in that task force were the Revenue Department, the Employment Department, the Bureau of Labor and Industries, the Workers' Compensation Division, and those agencies have already started working together on the assumption and the hope that, this bill will be passed to begin to develop those common rules, common guidelines, and the industry guidelines that that Lisa referred to. Section 4 conforms the definition of employment for the employment department for unemployment insurance covered employment is or that if a person is an independent contractor, as that term is defined in this bill, they are not performing services that are covered employment for purposes of the unemployment insurance statute. Section 5 would repeal the conflicting provision of Senate Bill 232 from last session. Section 6 is a conforming amendment for the Revenue Department, as is Section 7. And Section 8 specifies that the new definition will apply as of January 1, 2006, to services provided on or after that date. I'd be happy to answer any questions about the actual text of the bill. I would like to say that the task force was a very broad-based group. Members worked very, very hard, and there are some more folks here from the task force, I think, who've signed up to testify, and would urge you to listen to them.
Thank you, Elizabeth. Any questions? I don't see any. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you all. Let's see. We have run out of time, so could I have Chris De Silva and Paula Hubble? Is that it?
I'm Krista Sylvia, and I'm here to discuss the plight of travel agents. Paul and I are president and vice president of the American Society of Travel Agents Oregon chapter. And I'm here today because I want to bring to your attention a very unique situation that will affect our industry. And I've provided some documentation to you. This is a ruling that took place with the Division of Employment. And it represents travel agency that had independent contractors. The reason that this is significant is because the findings of fact specifically tie the ability to write an airline ticket to whether or not an individual should be considered an employee. Now, we have... a situation that's unique also in that the Airline Reporting Corporation, if you don't have any background in it, they are a clearinghouse for airline tickets and distribution to the airlines themselves. The cost of being ARC appointed is substantial. It requires bonding of between $10,000 and $70,000 a year. Requires specific safety issues with regard to airline tickets themselves. Documents need to be secured. So it's not an easy task for an individual to have the ability to write tickets without networking to an organization, an agency. Now, an agency could not have any stipulations, any obligations or place any requirements of an agent. The agent could be free to issue tickets through the internet, through a distribution channel such as itself. It could bypass agencies and go to tour operators directly. But the significance of the finding says that if you issue an airline ticket for an independent contractor, you've in essence made them an employee. I have been involved and have seen cases whereby independent contractors have been taken to task by the employment division. And one of the situations that came up was an individual that delivered airline tickets, as an example. This person delivered tickets for multiple people, and the agent who ran an individual independent company was told that this person was not an independent, but that they were an employee, and they classified them as employees. And they began reviewing all of the other industry relationships that she had. The only ones that she had protection through were those that had been incorporated. Those were the ones that they bypassed and they overlooked, but they chose to single out an individual who delivered tickets for multiple individuals, not just her. With regard to ARC, there's also a catch-22 that occurs in that in order to apply with ARC, you have to have the ability to issue airline tickets. So it's a catch-22 in that you have to be able to issue a ticket before you can be appointed to issue a ticket. And in so doing, you create a relationship with a host agency that in essence drives your tickets for you. They need that because they have to demonstrate the ability to issue the tickets. And in so doing, that relationship then becomes that of an employee. This is an industry that has been very compressed. We are experiencing tremendous hardship. We have gone in the last 10 plus years to zero commission. We struggle to find an environment that we can succeed in. The agents themselves, through this, the majority of agencies, an overwhelming majority, as an industry standard, practice with independent contractors. And this is a nationwide trend. Agents can seek relationships with organizations that do not remain within the border of a city or a state. The airlines themselves have sought distribution channels, reservation services that are handled overseas. I had an individual that I'm aware of that was in Russia and logged into her computer and brought up her airline computer there. This is something that can be done anywhere that you can have a computer plugged into. And as a result of that, we are experiencing, or I believe we will experience losses in the industry to individuals that will seek out partnerships with organizations outside of our state. Sitting here, I had heard that the individual that spoke prior to me had said that in 2007 these amendments could be addressed, or the concerns could be addressed through legislative process. I'm trying to reach a sympathetic ear to say this industry doesn't have until 2007, because an audit that takes place through this year or 2006 could bankrupt an organization. This is something that we feel very strongly about, and I'm imploring you to allow us to have an amendment that is specific to this industry based on ARC. Thank you.
Thank you. Go ahead, your testimony.
Representative Brown and committee members. This is an industry that has been through...
I need to have you identify yourself.
Oh, I'm sorry. My name is Paula Hobble. I am the president of the American Society of Travel Agents for Oregon. I would like to implore that you look at amendment for our industry. Please realize we're not asking that or telling you that everyone in our industry is an independent contractor. It is the norm in our industry to have people with specialties or people with their own clientels who are already operating as independent small businesses to work through a regularly appointed travel agency. This is the norm. Our concern is that the ruling that was put down for that you have before you has made us a little unique. The one of the bills we heard at the very beginning had to do with women in the workplace. As a mother of three children, and I don't mean to embarrass you, Representative Kitts, but also who breastfed three children while working, this industry, the travel agency industry, is a good industry for women who have their own clientels, their own specialties, and this is one way they can work from their homes. The trend in our industry is to work from your home. Not all of our employees, but the people who perhaps had small agencies that are now closing. All of your cities, all of your counties that you represent have several agencies that have closed. Many have gone home. Many have taken their clientels, would like to have a relationship with an Oregon company rather than a company in Illinois, a company in California, a company in Washington. And by restricting us so that we can't work with them, they will go out of state. And that is why we would like to look at an amendment.
Thank you. Did you have, I don't recall, did you have any opportunity to participate or sit in on any of the interim task force when they were working through this?
We had not become aware of this issue until approximately 2.5 or 3 weeks ago. Thank this had been brought to our attention from a lobbyist who had helped with ASTA issues in last legislative session.
Thank you. Any questions? I don't see any. Thank you very much for your testimony. We're getting down close to the wire.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
I don't know if appropriate, but if the remaining folks, if they have simply written testimony, maybe they could submit it for the record, and those that don't could testify in the name of time.
Okay. Well, and I think for the committee and for those people that are here to testify, it's obvious we're not going to work our way through this morning. The speaker said we gave us a little wiggle room to noon, and then we have to be on the House floor. And so the bill will have to be brought back for further testimony. I apologize for anyone that's traveled any distance to get here today. And it'll be in it. And it's my intention as early as possible next week to bring it back again. And is there anyone here that can't make it back to Salem if they want to testify or don't have a written testimony to submit to us?
Mr.
Chair. Sure. Sure. Come up, please.
It doesn't mean hide your written testimony so you get to talk either.
I appreciate that. I did not bring written testimony. My name is Jeffrey Chacoin. I'm a member of the task force. I'm a labor and employment lawyer representing businesses in Portland, Oregon. I just wanted to give the committee the perspective of a business lawyer and a business employment lawyer on this bill, Senate Bill 323. It's a very good bill. It's not a deal from a business standpoint. But it's much better than what we currently have. It's something we can work with in the future, either through rulemaking or future legislation. And I urge you to support it. That's all I have.
Thank you, Jeff. Appreciate that. Nancy?
Chair Brown and representatives, I'm sorry, I'm practicing pharmacist, and I'm not sure next week if I could get the stores covered. I really had to hustle to get off today.
Give us your name for the record. And
my name is Nancy Cabe, and I live in Dallas, Oregon. I own and operate a brokerage for independent contractor pharmacists in the state of Oregon. I've done so for 18 years. I'm a practicing pharmacist, past president of the Pharmacists Association.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
Is it the intent of the witness to simply read her testimony that has already been passed out?
Because I'm looking for legislative intent, it's real important that I'm in front of you guys, if that's okay. It's real short, and I'll be real quick. Is that okay? Chair Brown. I'm before you today because after 8 years of what can only be called a battle with the Employment Division, I've recently come out on the other side of the battle with the Supreme Court decision in my favor, mandating that the Employment Division pay significant legal fees. Because of my past experiences with your Employment Division and the disdain which they treat the laws which you have written, and because I'm afraid of the misapplication of your intent, I ask that you give verbal legislative intent on a few broadly written pieces of Senate Bill 323, which I very much support. These pieces affect many small businesses, not just my own. The past bill also had this language. It is old language, but they had legislative intent in the old bill. And so this new bill is a new slate, and the legislative intent that you put on it is what is attached to it. The two points that I have an issue with, page 2, number 3, small a, large b. The person maintains a business location that is in a portion of the business residence, and that portion is used primarily for the business. The concern that I have is that the very broadly written primarily used for business could be construed when an agency is trying to hurt a business, to be interpreted as if you worked 40 hours outside of your business home office and came back to it and just did your billing and your scheduling, that you would not meet primarily. And I think there's a quite significant number of independent contractor businesses that function this way. When they have a home office, that's why they have a home office. They're not there very much. And also that primarily could be considered that there's not single space. I guess I'm just asking you to have legislative intent that if someone works in that manner, that their home office would be considered appropriate in this language. And the second piece that I had is page 2, 3, small c, the person provides contracted services for two or more different persons in a 12-month period. The problem here is that many independent contractors work as brokers. And this language certainly could include those people, or if the agency is after these people, it could be considered that the broker was the one person they worked through. And I would just like legislative intent that it is okay to work through a broker. I'm not the only business. There's many, many businesses run this way in the state. And just if the chair and the representatives would consider that something that you would intend in this bill, that would be very, very wonderful. And I appreciate your time at this last minute.
Thank you. Thank you for testifying. And with that, committee, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 323. And we are supposed to be on the floor at 12 o'clock, and so I will adjourn the committee.
Adjourn.